you just joined us, you are listening to the music of Jake Blunt and his band. They're the headliners for the Folk Festival this year. Stay with us. We'll be talking with Jake shortly. So while Jake is getting ready to take a seat here to talk with us, I wanted to introduce Sherry Patterson, who is president of the Black Awareness Association of Juneau, and her love of gospel music is well known in this town. She helps put on a gospel workshop and concert during Black History Month, and I just know that you would love to talk with Jake because he has done so much work in researching Black History Month. And as well as the history of some of the instruments that are played in bluegrass that have African-American roots.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting me, Rhonda. This is a pleasure.
Thank you, young man, for being here
in our capital city of Alaska. Have you ever been here before?
No, this is my first time.
Welcome. We look forward to hearing from you later on. So, Rhonda, again, thank you so much. And Jake, hey, just tell us who you are for those who have not been introduced to you. Who is Jake Blunt?
So I am a folk musician, whatever that means to you. I originally come from Washington, D.C., but I make my home in Providence, Rhode Island these days. This is my first time to Alaska, and most of what I do is study and perform music that comes out of Black and Indigenous traditions in the southeastern United States. That's a large part of my family's roots. It's what I like to spend my time studying, and that song even was one that came from not far from where my family's from in southeastern Virginia.
Okay.
State Penitentiary, Virginia is the name of that town.
Okay.
Yeah, my family's from Smithfield.
Uh-huh.
But yeah.
I said when I looked you up today when I knew I was coming to talk to you, and I loved your music.
Thank you. I absolutely
love it, and have not listened to a whole lot of bluegrass, but that I have, it's been enjoyable. Not necessarily my, you know, but I think you're probably going to convert me. So I said, okay, we have a young black man playing a banjo from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
That is not typical of my culture. So let me ask you this. Do you have any roots in Louisiana? I'm from Louisiana.
I don't.
And your last name, Blunt, is a Louisiana name.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And your music reminded me of Zydeco music from Louisiana. So I'm like, does he have any Louisiana roots?
There's a big relationship there. I don't personally have Louisiana roots.
Okay.
I mean, you know how our families are.
Right.
They spread.
I'm sure I have cousins there.
Yes. But I think probably actually what you might be hitting on is there's this regional style up in Ithaca, New York, where I really learned to play music and where Gus did as well, my guitar player. And it has this really strong, like, backbeat swing feel to it that is really similar at times to a Cajun or Zydeco.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that's probably what you heard.
I forgot which one I clicked first, but I'm like,
was it the Angels Done Bowed Down?
Possibly.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's Zydeco music.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a big relationship there. A lot
okay.
of the people who play in that scene up in Ithaca also play Cajun music. So.
Okay. All righty. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Jake, Who influenced you as you were coming into where you find yourself today? Who was your who did you look to? Who drew you to this genre?
I think there's a couple answers to that. I first found my way into this music when I was still living back in D.C. I was a high school student and went to go see a I was actually going to a dubstep concert and wound up stopping for Ethiopian food on the way and ran into this band in this Ethiopian restaurant on U Street in downtown D.C. And they were called Megan Jean and the KFB. And their banjo player, Byrne, was playing banjo and in a way that I'd never seen before. Wow. I played guitar at that point, electric guitar, so I knew enough to know it was different than what I was used to seeing. And I went up and asked him about it, and he told me the story of how the banjo, you know, was descended from African instruments, that it mm-hmm. took shape in the hands of enslaved black people in the United States. And that just gave me this really direct familial connection that was always my main reason for wanting to learn the instrument. And once I got into it, I found about folks like the Carolina Chocolate Drops, Rhiannon Giddens, Kaya Cater, honestly, who's my contemporary but has been in it way longer than I have, who really were doing a lot of the work I aspired to be doing and showed me my way into it as well.
Okay. All right. So are you strictly bluegrass or would you – okay. What else do you do?
I think that's in flux.
Okay.
And I know y'all were just talking about playing the recorded version of The Man Was Burning earlier, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is completely different. And that's because I was recording it on my own during the pandemic. I wrote all of the pieces for that track and played everything myself except for the bass. So it turned into a rock and roll song because that's what I had the ability to do. And I've been reading so much about Sister Rosetta Tharpe right now, who, you know, folks may know. She's this queer black woman from back in the day who took her electric guitar and gave voice to these old spirituals and invented rock and roll, mm-hmm. And influenced the Chuck Berrys and the Little Richards and the Elvis Presleys of those days. So she was really the founder of that. I really wanted to try doing something like that. And The Man Was Burning is what shook out. That's a piece of what's going on. I do a few different things. I've been doing blues. I've been doing some what we call old time music, which is a little bit different than bluegrass, even though it kind of sounds the same a lot of the time, and some bluegrass as well. I'm interested in learning all of it, and we'll see what I have time on this earth to learn.
Well, I tell you, it's great to have you here, and I'm so glad, Rhonda. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today.
Well, I'm so happy to have you here with us because I'm curious, you know, about what kinds of influences that, for example, are in gospel music that we don't even realize are African American. I know that that's something that you're real familiar with. And Jake, you know, I think it's so interesting that you rarely see black musicians play bluegrass. Mm-hmm. There is a band in Anchorage, based in Anchorage in South Central Alaska, called Blackwater Railroad, and they actually do have or have had a black member.
Awesome.
Isaac London, I believe, is his name. But it's like such a rare thing to see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet, I guess if you know the history, it shouldn't be, should it?
No, not at all. And it's not a coincidence that it wound up this way. In that, in the early days, back when, especially when you look at like the banjo came over here, right? The banjo, we know, first appeared with that name in 1678 in the Black Codes in Martinique, which were restricting gatherings of enslaved black people and specifically referenced a string instrument called the banza that they like to dance to. That's our first written documentation of it, and we know that only a couple decades passed before it made its way to the continental United States there and started spreading amongst the enslaved population there. At the same time, we know that the fiddle was already widely played in those populations. We know there were a ton of black people playing the violin back in the day. And we know that there are both banjo-like instrument and fiddle traditions that existed in Africa prior to people being brought to the United States or to any other part of the Americas. There's a long history of involvement with these instruments. And what wound up happening is that early in the days when people started going out and recording the music commercially, the early record industry decided that it would not be profitable to market black people playing this type of music. They decided that white musicians would be recorded playing what they called at the time hillbilly music, which is early country, early folk, what turned into bluegrass in old time and these things that we know today. and the black people would be recorded playing race music, which was blues, jazz, and eventually they cottoned on to gospel, but it took some time, right? Mahalia Jackson had to convince them. And it was a hard sell. So back in the day, they split the artists up based on their race, not on what they were playing or what they sounded like. And that meant that black people who were playing this hillbilly music, quote unquote, were left out. They were not recorded and they were not committed to the canon of historical recordings that we have, except in small numbers by the very few folklorists who were interested in capturing that. So a lot got lost and we're still in the process of rebuilding it. And you see more and more of us every year. So it's happening, but it's going to be a long journey uphill.
So what does knowing this heritage do to your music? How does it infuse it with something special?
I'm still kind of trying to understand that. I think I came at the music from such an academic perspective, having really dug into the information before I started playing and done so much of my learning while I was at college. I intellectualized a lot of things that I don't think are really intellectual in that same way, at least. And I'm still kind of trying to parse that there is a connection there. And I've had mentors pointed out to me, including one named Kathy Fink, who's really been super supportive of me throughout my career. And she came up to me and not in a like negative, insulting way was, you know, we were talking about my show and she was like, the thing that draws people to you is not like your technical skill. Not to say that I don't have any, but she was like, there's a connection there between you and the music that other people don't have. And people feel that in the room, and that's what draws them into your show. And I've been spending a lot more time thinking about that. I just finished a new project that really brought me into a lot closer contact with those other things and with the physical and spiritual and psychological things that I experience while I'm playing music that I can't necessarily explain using my academic terminology. It's something I'm still trying to figure out, but figuring out while I'm playing. So,
well, why don't you play us a tune? But before we do that, I just want to ask you, what is the story that you're telling in the song "The Man Was Burning"?
Yeah. So this is the question. The original song comes from an inmate named Joe Lee, who was incarcerated in State Penitentiary, Virginia in 1936. He was 71 years old in 1936 when that song was recorded. I don't know what he could have done to be in jail at 71 years old. But as we know, the southern states passed a lot of laws to throw black people in there to replace the slave labor they had recently lost in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And that may have been part of why he was still there. The original version of the song is about a gambler. It's about a man who's sitting down on a log gambling with his buddies, and God strikes him down for it. There are a lot of songs specifically about gambling from that time and place. I'm not sure whether there was a real feeling of, like, moral panic around gambling back in those days, but you hear it all
there
the time.
Was.
Yeah, yeah.
There was,
there,
yeah.
I mean, you know, there's all these old songs that are about, you know, broke, you know, they're
going to hell because
exactly.
Playing cards. Yep.
Yeah, and that's really what it was. The thing that's interesting to me, I rewrote it because I personally, I don't have strong objections to people gambling. It's not like how I spend my time, but you do you. So I whenever I do a rewrite, I try to make sure that I'm not taking the song out of the original cultural context. So knowing that this is like a black Christian song from that period in time, I look at like the black Christian theology that's been passed down in my family, my community, and go, what are things that I do agree with? You know, where are the things that I do feel like I have some synchronicity with the original culture here? And what it was to me was about hoarding wealth. So I rewrote the song to be about somebody who's, you know, greedy and hoarding wealth and overestimating what it can do for him and how important it is compared to the other things we should maybe be prioritizing in this day and age, and is punished by God for that. The interesting thing, and what I think we were just talking around before we went on the air here, is the imagery of the song is really close to a lynching.
When I was, like I said, I was doing some research on you, that was the only song I didn't click on.
Yep.
Because I thought it was about lynching.
Yes.
I really did, and I didn't want to go there today,
no.
Emotionally. And so, yeah, that's just what I thought.
Yeah, and I, you know, even sending it after it was done, I sent it to my father, who, you know, grew up in rural Virginia during segregation, and he was wondering. Now, I don't think that that's what the song was about, just based on the way that it was explained or the way that the original verses structured the narrative. But I think it's so telling that when we visualize, like, a draconian punishment from the other world, it comes through as this man being suspended from a tree and set on fire. Mm-hmm. Like, that, you know, that was the worst punishment
yes.
that black people in that time and place could envision. And that was this kind of arbitrary moral force, you know, forcing a thing on you and punishing you without giving you a chance to defend yourself for doing something that isn't hurting anybody. There's so many different narratives that are bound up in that song. And I think when I rewrote that, I could have taken it in 15 different directions. I chose to, you know, do the one that seemed most obvious to me. But yeah, the imagery is striking. And there's a lot of complexity buried in these old folk songs.
There is.
Yeah, there is a lot.
Yeah.
And it's so good that you're kind of peeling those layers mm-hmm. for us. Well, I think the audience here, our listeners, would be disappointed if we didn't hear more music. So what would you like to play for us next?
And can I ask one more question?
Oh, yes. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. You're a young man, obviously. Mm-hmm. You're not 50 or...
Yes,
you know.
26.
26.
Yes.
You're very young. What so far? Because you have a blossoming career mm-hmm. ahead of you, I can tell.
Well, thank you.
I don't know what all you've accomplished so far. But what so far has been your greatest achievement?
I think that's always a tricky thing for me to say, because when you're in an industry like music, so much of what you talk about and what you're supposed to be proud of is like things that have been handed to you from the outside. Where I think the probably on paper the most important thing I've done is I received the Steve Martin Banjo Prize in 2020, I think, or
okay.
2021.
Congratulations.
One of the pandemic years. It happened. And thank you. I mean, that's, you know, it's one of the biggest awards, if not the biggest, for my
wow.
instrument. And it, you know, that's super meaningful to me.
Congratulations.
That and having won yeah. at the Appalachian String Band Music Festival, which we in the scene call Clifftop, those are kind of the two biggest things you can do as a clawhammer banjo player. Those were both really big moments for me. But I think in terms of things that are meaningful to me and are close to the reason that I'm playing this music, it's really moments of connecting with people who I really respect and who I really want to be in musical communion with. I got the chance to play with a band called the Ebony Hillbillies recently, who are, you know, this band of black folks who are playing this music, you know, 20, 30 years before the rest of us started
right.
reviving it. I mean, they really, like, led the charge in some ways, paved the way for the Carolina Chocolate Drops, who paved it for the rest of us. Getting to play music with them was incredible.
Wow.
I met them a couple weeks ago and got to be on stage with them. And
awesome.
It's moments of feeling really attached to the tradition and the community like that, that I think are meaningful to me, even if they're not necessarily the most impressive things on paper.
Well, keep doing what you're doing. You're blessing a whole lot of people, and there's more to come from you. And we look forward to hearing your name at the Grammys one day.
Perhaps it'll happen.
So what are you doing next for us?
We're going to do a tune called We're Going to Hunt the Buffalo. We're going to hunt the buffalo. And I get to do a little bit of banjo tuning as I work on this one. Sorry, did I mislead
Real
my
quick,
band? I might have misled
Tell us a little
band.
Bit about your banjo. It looks very authentically aged.
Yeah, well, that's the funny part. People look at this banjo, and to those of you coming to the folk festival, you'll see it. It looks pretty old, but in fact, it was built for me in 2018.
Oh,
so
wow.
it's not that old. But it was built by this really incredible maker, Cedars Instruments, up in Dorset, Vermont. I think Will there is building the best banjos that are out there right now. It's just incredible. We gotta do a little bit of tuning to get to this next one. For anybody who's listening and not familiar, old-time music involves using some different tunings depending on the key and depending on the song. And this next one is particularly unusual. I learned it from a recording of a man named Jimmy Driftwood, who was from Western Arkansas. And he grew up right next to what was at the time Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma. and learned some music from folks that he met over there. So this is one that he told us he learned from two Indian boys, which is an unfortunate, you know, vague way of expressing who these people were. But he gave us some useful clues, including that they were part of something called the Green Corn Dance, which is usually associated with tribes from the East Coast. So a hint to me that probably they were folks who were sent there via Indian Removal Act rather than were native to Oklahoma itself. He lived right next to the Cherokee part of Indian Territory, so most likely this is a tune with Cherokee origins.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is.
The things we don't know about the music we hear.
The things we don't knew. No.
I think they're going to find their tuning's a little bit different with Juno's humidity.
Don't
you think?
Yeah.
Cherry.
Yeah.
Jake is here with his band. He's got George Jackson on the fiddle and Gus Tritch, who plays guitar, banjo, and uke. And Molly Obomsawin is also here on the bass, rocking a great big stand-up bass.
Yeah.
So we have about 9 more minutes for a little more conversation. And, of course, we'll ask you, if you don't mind, to just play us out of the program. If you could do one more tune for us before we go. So Jake is here with his band, and they'll be performing at the Folk Festival and also be doing some workshops as well. So maybe for people that are very interested in what you have to offer, can you tell us a little bit about what your workshop will be about?
Yeah, I think our workshops are mostly on concrete instrumental stuff. So I'm pretty sure I'm teaching one on clawhammer banjo. I think George is doing one on bluegrass banjo.
Bluegrass banjo and bluegrass fiddle.
So wow. So we'll learn some bluegrass. George is a seasoned professional. Where is George from?
He's got a touch of an accent.
Tennessee, obviously. That's where I live now, but I grew up in New Zealand. Yeah.
Oh. Ah.
Yeah, and then Gus will be teaching a guitar workshop, I think.
Okay.
So
this is a chance for people to experience you and your whole band in many different ways. You know, Sherry, one of the things I'm curious about is you go to a place like Nashville and you go to Memphis, and it's like there are two worlds. And so Nashville kind of represents kind of the heart of bluegrass music, places like North Carolina. But it's totally divorced from its roots, really, in some ways. Can you talk about that a little bit? Just that we have these separate worlds, and somehow this music got separated.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing there is really that the ways that we addressed that race music, hillbilly music dichotomy that came about early in the days of the record industry, where they were splitting people up based on their race instead of the music they were making, that didn't really get changed, right? We changed the names of the categories, but still to this day, right, you look at, say, Leslie Riddle, who was the guitarist who traveled around with A.P. Carter of the Carter family, one of the most important bands in early country music history. Leslie Riddle was a disabled black man who traveled around with A.P. Carter, a white man, and went collecting all these songs that the Carter family later went on to record in the early days of the country music industry and win acclaim. They're an early country band. Leslie Riddle did not get recorded until decades on decades later because he was black. And when he got recorded, playing the same body of music, he was listed as a blues musician, right? Mm-hmm. And you still see that carried through today. I think some of the Carolina Chocolate Drops music, if you go like buy it on iTunes, is listed under blues. And that's not to say that blues is inherently a restrictive category or anything like that. But I think what you're pointing to right there is that Nashville is the seat of the industry for genres that have been specifically coded as white the entire time, right? From the moment those genres were invented, it was with the understanding that only white people would be playing them. And I think that Nashville has diversified beyond that. I mean, George lives there, so he can maybe speak to this better than me. But I know I've spent time there. I know there's, you know, Allison Russell is down there. I know Yola's down there, right? Rhiannon Giddens was living there for a while. There's a good deal of important work happening inside Nashville that I never want to discount when we have that conversation. But absolutely, the legacy of those racial divides is still there. We've never really addressed that the genres we are used to and that we reference when we talk about music were designed to separate people based on race, first and foremost.
Wow. You're going to be back to Juno. That's all I have to say. My wheels are turning right now. How I can get you back. This is awesome. This is incredible.
I love it.
You'll be hearing from me, young man.
I hope so. We're loving it. Molly and I already bought a guitar.
And when are you performing? Maybe we should say that. Do you have the times and the days?
We are performing at 8 tonight.
Okay.
On the main stage.
Okay.
So I guess at the Centennial Center?
Centennial Hall. Right,
yes.
Across the street.
And then we're performing there again on Sunday. Is it also at 8? I don't have this.
8:45.
It might be 8:45.
8:45 on Sunday.
Evening. If you look up the festival schedule, it'll be on there. We are on the road and therefore only know what we have to do today. But we will.
And I just have to ask you this because your mom is very famous. Jean, you get this a lot, but I'm a broadcaster and worked in TV news as well. And I have a young son, and he had to grow up working growing up around my crazy schedule, and I'm sure that you had the same kind of life. And of course, your dad is a producer, right?
Director.
A director. So you grew up in that milieu, and how did you come out sane?
Is the lasting question. My sister and I talk about it frequently. We're like, are we okay? I don't know. No, I think my parents had a really good system worked out. I mean, as you know, being a broadcast journalist is such a labor-intensive job. And I think it was probably pretty powerful for my sister. And I think definitely perspective-changing for me to have our mom specifically out doing a job like that. And you know, killing it at the top of her industry and doing such a good job. We're so proud of what she was able to do. And she and my dad have both moved on to other things. But during that time in our family, my dad, because he was a director, he was home most of the time. So, you know, when she was gone, my dad was able to still be taking us to school. You know, he would come home and spend his lunch break with us so he could get some time with us. And fortunately, you know, because my parents were making enough money, we were able to have childcare. So, you know, it wasn't as precarious as that kind of situation with both parents working can be for so many families, especially now. But, it's still something I'm learning as an adult, especially, you know, growing up with her doing that in DC of all places. I remember driving back home to do something. Not long ago, I drove over the bridge and, like, three attack helicopters in close formations, like, laden with missiles, drove right over the bridge. And I was like, that was not normal. I grew up thinking this was 100% normal. It is not normal. There's, like, a level of, like, absolute craziness that you have to be comfortable with. It's a process that's ongoing for me, learning all the ways in which that upbringing is strange.
Well, yeah. We've got just a minute left in our show. Actually, only 30 seconds.
Oh.
this has just slipped by so quickly.
Yes.
And I wish we could have time for another song, but I'm afraid we don't.
So, oh, no.
I want to thank Sherry Patterson for co-hosting.
It's been an honor.
Today, and
yes.
Thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.